Goddard Reel 1. What were your first experiences in the field of aviation?
Well, I suppose the first was when a boy in my term at Dartmouth, I used to be a naval cadet in the Navy, asked me if I would help to make an invention of his respectable. I happened to know that his mother had taken him flying at the early age of 13 years of age, and that he'd been imbued with this, and he had thought that there was something about the air which hadn't been thought of by other people, and that you could drop bombs from the air. And he had devised a bomb sight which allowed for the drift of the aeroplane in the air and also for its forward speed of flight. And this was something which was new to me, and I think was new to the whole world. So as he wasn't highly regarded in the amongst the authorities, and as I was had fairly good record, he said, would I help to sponsor his invention? And so we took it to the captain, whom I knew quite well, Captain Victor Stanley, who was impressed with this and sent the invention to the Admiralty. And we waited for some time, and then we were sent for by the captain one day. We went to the commander's office, in fact, and there the captain came in and told us that he'd had a nice letter, but not a very helpful one, from the Admiralty, which began that their lordships were had commanded the writer to inform Captain Stanley, or Officer Commanding Dartmouth, that the invention submitted by the two naval cadets had been considered, and that they were to be thanked for their ingenuity, but to be informed that their lordships saw no application for the invention.
I wonder if you have any recollections of the bomb sight itself, what its principles were.
Well, it was simply two points, one of which, the top one, was variable, and you could move a slide out sideways to allow for sideways drift, or leeway as we called it, and you could move the whole thing forward a little bit, depending on the speed at which you estimated you were travelling over the ground or the sea. And this gave a variable point in relation to a fixed point below, which gave you a line of sight for putting your eyes onto the object that you were aiming at. You've lined up this sight for these two factors, drift and speed, and when the beads, or the two blobs, came in line with the target, you pulled the string and dropped your bomb. And that allowed the bomb to fly forwards and sideways on its way to the ground, so that it would theoretically hit the target when it got there.
With the wisdom of hindsight, do you think that this device would have been practicable?
It certainly should not have been turned down. It would have been the beginnings of what was invented later on. Exactly the same principle was inherent in the same bomb sights, which had to be invented several years later during World War I, when the aircraft which were employed in France began to be used offensively instead of merely as the eyes for seeing the other side of the hill.
What was the earliest occasion on which you saw air power used in anger?
Well, we were at the receiving end of the first Zeppelin attack on a military target in this country. Hitherto, they had dropped some bombs in open fields in East Anglia, but when I was in dry dock in a battleship called the Britannia at Hebburn, which is just near Newcastle, I, as a midshipman with four or five other midshipmen, was doing an exercise of Morse code flashing reading signals under an instructor in the open air on the after shelter deck of this battleship, when we heard a whistling sound in the air, which astonished us, and it was immediately followed by two deafening explosions, which apparently were just off to our left, to in the water, in the Tyne. And that din was immediately followed by three other whistling sounds, which we thought was going to be followed by equally shattering explosions, but it was followed by three quick plops in the wet end of the dry dock. And then we saw there were three flaming lights down in the dry dock. These were three incendiary bombs which had fallen just on the sill of the dock, just missing the quarterdeck of the battleship, missing the side of the dock, and falling in a little cluster very close to the dock gates. The explosive bombs had fallen just the other side of the dock gates, so it was really a very fine shot. We knew that we'd been bombed from the air. We knew that Zeppelins had been over the country. We looked up into the sky, and which was then very cloudy, with breaks in the clouds, silver lines, so to speak, in the bright moonlight, and we saw flying across a gap between the clouds, very high up, as I know now, but didn't know then, it must have been at least 15, 20,000 feet, a Zeppelin. And this was obviously the explanation of what had happened to us, and that was the first time.
How much actual damage do you remember these half dozen or so bombs did?
They did no damage at all, except that the two explosive bombs that fell in the Tyne slightly buckled part of the dock gate so that it leaked a little bit, but not enough to put anything out of action or to cause anybody any trouble. It was a mercy. They fell in the water about 30 or 40 yards away from the dock gates.
What do you remember of the reactions, both of the naval personnel and the civilians in the area, to this first raid?
Well, nothing about the reaction of the civilians, quite a lot about the reactions of the service personnel, because next day a group of military officers, headed by what was then called a brigadier general, would now be called a brigadier, came on board the ship to see the captain, to talk about this thing, and we understood that he'd come from army headquarters, goodness knows where. And after they'd gone, another group of military officers came to do the same investigation. And we learned then, but this may have been apocryphal, that the first group were unknown to the second group and were declared by the second group to have been a group of enemy agents dressed up as military officers who were investigating. I should think that was quite apocryphal. I should think it was quite possible that there were two military headquarters who didn't know what each other were doing. But whether that was so or not, the reaction was that we had been the victims of a premeditated attack on a battleship, and that the German enemy agents knew all about this and then came and got their facts verified. But I have since doubted that story very much.
Was there any serious naval reaction to this raid from the point of view of assessing the significance of this new form of attack from the air?
Well, you must remember that I was in the gunroom then, which was a very low form of life, and I wouldn't have conversations with very senior officers about it. But it was quite clear that the Navy was confident that gun power was the thing that mattered, and that bomb power was almost negligible. The effect of the bombs dropped on us had been to do no really important damage, and so they just brushed it aside and forgot about it, I think. I don't think there was any reaction that was worth talking about.
What were the circumstances of your transfer to the Royal Naval Air Service?
Well, I was in a battleship at Rosyth when one morning I was required to report to the captain. This was an unusual happening. I was at that moment attending divisions, preparatory to marching aft on the quarterdeck, and to be sent for by the captain was alarming. I went down to his cabin. I found the commander there and the captain's clerk, who was a paymaster type, and he bade the other two go away, and the commander was hesitant to leave me with the captain at this stage, but anyway, they both went, and the captain then approached me, laid his hand on my shoulder and said to me, My boy, I have a very serious question to ask you. I fear the consequences of some malaction of my own, which I wasn't aware of at the time. But anyway, he looked at me steadily and said, "Are you prepared to volunteer for special temporary service of a secret and hazardous nature?" And, of course, I was prepared for no such thing. But nevertheless, I'd been trained always to answer positively, and so I said, "Yes, sir." So he then said, "Well, I'll send your name forward to the Commander-in-Chief. I have a letter here which asks me to submit the name of any officer I think suitable who volunteers for this service. I can't tell you what it is, but at least I will put your name forward." At that point, the commander knocked on the door again and said that the hands were marched off for prayers, and the captain told him to go and attend to it and leave him alone. So consequently, of course, there was a great deal of consternation about what went on, as the captain didn't come on deck as usual, and I wasn't there either. And the gunroom at lunchtime put me on the spot to declare what the relationship was and what was going on. And I said that I was sworn to secrecy on this, and I couldn't utter any more about it. And after a good deal of bullying, because I was the most junior officer in that gunroom, and all the rest of them were sub-lieutenants, acting sub-lieutenants, except one other midshipman who was the same seniority as me. Well, nothing happened, and so it was a sort of seven-day wonder. But about 3 weeks later, we were playing deck hockey in Rosyth again. We'd been out to sea in the meantime. We were back when the captain's messenger came and said that Midshipman Goddard was required. And so there was some consternation. Well, I went below again, sweaty with hockey, and captain said that I had been selected for this service and that I was to leave the ship. I think he said at nightfall. He could have said at seven bells. I just don't remember just when he said. But I then said, could he tell me what we were going to do? And he said, as far as he knew, it was an open-air job, but he didn't know anything about it. I should pack a seaman's bag and take just a change of clothes, a spare pair of boots, otherwise to take a very minimum amount of kit. It would only be temporary service, and I should be coming back later on. So I bade farewell. He said, you can tell the gunroom now about this. And so I told the gunroom. The bar was opened, and we had a couple of pints of beer all round each and discussed the possibilities of this thing. I then had to dash off and pack my seaman's bag, only to get a message from the wardroom that I was required there. And there I was plied with sherry, because everybody wanted to know what I was going to do. So you can imagine that after this treatment, when I tottered after my sealed orders from the captain, I was perhaps just a little unsteady. However, I went up on deck, the picket boat having been called away, and the wardroom, all the senior officers in the ship, came up to see me off very decently, but none of the gunroom were. I assumed that they'd all stopped down there drinking beer. However, when we left the ship, I waved goodbye to those officers who were on the quarterdeck and stayed in the stern sheets of the picket boat, and we steamed away. And when we were out of sight of the ship, the fore hatch opened and all the gunroom came up on deck. They'd all stowed away in the fore peak of the picket boat, and they came aft to have a look at my sealed orders. And I showed them that it was marked strictly secret, or words to that effect. But they said, oh, to hell with that, we want to see them now. And I said, well, you can't have them. They said, well, we know that they're not supposed to be open until you get ashore, but you've got to do something when you go ashore, and we're coming ashore with you. So there was a struggle on the quay when we got to the end of the journey, and these orders were taken out of my hands, and they were torn open, and there they found another envelope inside marked not to be opened till 100 miles on the journey, and they gave up at that point. All the other thing was, the unsealed thing was a railway warrant to London, which they found, and so they knew I was going to London, and that they let me go. Well, I then left this party and went up to the station, which was quite nearby at Rosyth, and got aboard the train for London. And I reckoned that Newcastle was about 100 miles on the journey, and I thought there must be something significant about Newcastle that I'd probably get off about there. So as we were slowing down, I opened my sealed orders and found merely a chit saying, report at 10 a.m., or 10 hours, whatever it is, to the Second Sea Lord at the Admiralty on the following day. And that was all there was in the sealed orders. I had no particular point in the secrecy, except that there was another envelope, this was the third, under the sealed cover, addressed to Admiral Hamilton in my captain's handwriting. And that also was sealed. And so I didn't open that. But I got out on the platform when the train stopped and walked up and down a bit and saw another midshipman. And I recognised him as H.V. Drew, one term senior to me, and I hadn't seen him for some time, so I sidled up alongside him, but being junior, I didn't open the conversation, and he said, oh, what are you doing? And I said, I'm on this train. He said, oh, yes, well, I can see that, but where are you going? I said, I'm going to London, in fact. And so he said, what are you going to do there? I said, I don't really know. And he then replied, are you going to the Admiralty? I said, yes. 10 o'clock in the morning? I said, yes. He said, Second Sea Lord? I said, yes. And he said, well, so am I. I said, what are we going to do? He said, no, don't you know? He said, I said, no, it's too secret. And he said, well, it wasn't secret to me. I said, well, what are we going to do? He said, we're going to